Hey guys, Jim Steele here. Thanks for tuning in to Mare Talk. We do have a special guest today. He is John Clements, the director of the ARMA organization. He's going to tell us a little bit about himself in this first part of a two-part series. We're looking forward to listening to what he has to say, talking about some Mare, getting our sword on. Thanks for listening, guys. Hope you enjoy the show. To let our listeners know about yourself, you know, because there may be some people listening that aren't actually members, maybe inquiring how you got into Mare and how you came to become the director of the organization.
Okay, we have agreed to pronounce the word Mare and not Mare.
Okay,
Mare. Okay.
Yeah, because Mare sounds like, you know, mayor of a town, or it sounds like the anglicized version of Paul's Hector Mare, which is actually Meyer.
Meyer, okay.
Don't confuse him with Joachim Meyer from 1570. We say Mare, so we anglicized it.
Right.
And of course, the Germans hate that, but too damn bad.
That's right.
So, and then it was a discussion, should we, because some people were saying, well, the word mar is Latin for sea, as in ocean.
Right.
And so we said, well, we don't want to pronounce it mar, and we don't want people to think it's mar. So Stacy Clifford said, well, shouldn't it be like mar-re or mar-a, to emphasize the mars and mar? And I said, you're right. It really should be mar-a. So if you say mar-a or mar-re, that's either way, I don't care. But I tend to call it mar-a. Let's begin with this topic right here of what is our art called?
Sure. Right.
Because years ago, about 10 years ago, I kept having to write out the name of Dr. Anglo's book, The Martial Arts of Renaissance Europe. Mm-hmm. And so I started to just create an autocorrect on my computer so that I would type in all caps M-A-R-E, and it would go, blah, 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 you know, The Martial Arts of Renaissance Europe, the title of this book.
Right.
Sure.
And then after a while, certain people started saying, you know, Renmar, R-E-N-N-M-A-R. To mean Renaissance martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
And we started going, yeah, Renmar is cool. I practice Renmar, you know, and I was telling people about Renmar. And I thought, well, Renmar, that sounds weird. And then Dr. Anglo said, well, there's nothing wrong with creating a neologism, a new term that means our art. And I really can't stand the use of this word HEMA. The word HEMA is a good word if you mean the entirety of all European martial arts throughout history.
Precisely.
So if you say I'm researching Roman or Viking or Celtic or, you know, what have you, martial arts or Napoleonic or, you know, 19th century Italian stick fighting, whatever you're doing, that qualifies as historical and European and martial art. But if you're studying the source material that we study from, which is all firmly in the Renaissance, with the exception of the 133.
Mm-hmm.
And again, sometimes you'll see people call it the I-33, but that I is the Roman numeral 1, so it's actually the 133.
I see.
It's better to call it the Valpurgis Manual. So
Valpurgis.
That's clearly medieval, and it does influence what we're doing, but everything else, starting with Lichtenauer on up, it's firmly in that Renaissance culture and that Renaissance idea of referencing classical Greco-Roman culture and civilization. So, and then when you go up into sources that are from the late 1600s, well, unarguably Renaissance.
Mm.
So Dr. Anglo said, yeah, that's why I chose to call this the martial arts of Renaissance Europe, because it's specifically Western European and specifically the Renaissance. And the Renaissance only exists in one place and time, and that is Western Europe. And that the whole idea of the Renaissance being that time of rebirth and reflowering and recovery of lost knowledge. And certainly we are experiencing a Renaissance today in the study of HEMA. But when people say, I'm doing HEMA, I have to say, well, what do you mean?
Sure.
If someone's practicing Turkish martial arts, is that Western? Because they're arguing. Or if they're practicing stick fighting from the Canary Islands, well, is that Western or is that Arabic? Or if they're practicing Brazilian martial arts, is that Western?
Right.
What about something from the Caribbean? Is that Western? Or some stick, there's a stick fighting style at in the WOMAU, the World Martial Arts Union. They have a stick fighting style from Central America. And I'm like, so, okay, so all it is you have one, you have some basic techniques and some basic principles, and it's passed along in the vernacular, word of mouth. It's only like, you know, 150 years old. You have no way of knowing its origins as to whether or not it's derivative of some Filipino style or something, or if it's something indigenous. It's really not a codified systemology that you can, it's like, is it really a martial art? So,
right.
Professor Tom Green, the martial arts anthropologist, says, well, this is what we call vernacular martial art. And it doesn't have, as most of the world's martial arts do not have, the documented historiography of the martial arts of the Renaissance. So here, our martial arts, the forgotten martial arts, the lost martial arts, are the most documented martial arts in the history of humanity. There is no civilization that has produced the literature comparable to what we have and that we have available to study, whether it be Mayer or Meyer or Lichtenauer or the Fiores or what have you. Nothing is comparable to this.
So, right, right.
Powerful stuff, and it needs a name. And since you can have people going, well, I study Fiore and he's medieval. And it's like, yes and no. Or I'm studying Lichtenauer and that's... He originated in the 1350s, 1360s. Yeah, it is medieval, but I don't want to get caught, I know you don't either, between the medievalist on one hand and the Renaissance scholars on the other hand, arguing over whose territory covers what. Because the Renaissance is a gradual thing that develops in different regions of Europe at different times. And you'll have historians go as far to say, well, the Renaissance in architecture is not the same as the Renaissance in art, or the Renaissance in sculpture is not the same as the Renaissance in science, or the Renaissance in science not the same as the Renaissance in music. And it hits, say, England a different century than it hits Scandinavia, and it hits Germany at a different time than it hits parts of France. And it never hits parts of, say, Spain or Portugal or Poland. So they can point this out and you go, yeah, okay. So Dr. Anglo's contention is that, well, look, these guys are systematically studying self-defense in a way that they never have previously. It's a direct result of the introduction of firearms causing the introduction of plate armor. Oh, that's a new angle.
Wow.
Because, yeah, the past is, firearms get rid of plate armor. Ultimately, yes. But firearms spur the perfection of plate armor. So the adoption of plate armor does cause you to not need a shield. The free hand left over by not having a shield allows you to grip your weapon in two hands and to close into the half sword and to wrestle more. That encourages that training and those tactics. And then having the second hand and holding the weapon in half swording encourages a longer weapon. So you have thinner, more rigid, and longer weapons, yes, but the ideal weapon for plate armor is a shorter, narrower weapon. And yet the ignorant fencing historians of the 20th centuries assured us that plate armor caused heavier, bigger swords to beat it down and smash it. Wrong. The heavier, bigger swords come about as plate armor declines. That's when we see the great swords appear in the 16th century. And so all this comes together and Dr. Anglo says, yeah, you know, so this Renaissance, just like the Renaissance and everything else, grows. so that the appearance of the rapier, which again, the rapier, not the gentleman's weapon of elegant private dueling, but rather the street fighting weapon of, quote, brothel keepers, innkeepers, and shopkeepers fighting in the streets in chamois, in shirts. Not fighting with traditional knightly weapons, not engaging in traditional knightly combats and judicial duels and warfare instead, but using it basically in gang fights and urban militia conflicts. That's the origin of the rapier. And it's only later on that the fencers start to examine the rapier more scientifically and write about it systematically.
Right.
But so you have that thing going on in the Renaissance with art. And then parallel to the traditional knights and the masters of arms with their traditional teachings, you have the rise of the blue-collar fighting guilds as a parallel tradition.
Mm.
So all that is Mare. And wow, that means if you say I'm studying Fiore, well, okay, great, but I'm studying Fiore and Talhofer, or I'm studying Fiore, Talhofer, and Agrippa, or I'm studying Marozzo, Agrippa, and Viggiani, or I'm studying Swetnam and Hale and Silver and Degrassi. And so, you know, you can look at all of it and end up with a view that says this is the totality of this. And some people think, well, that means you're not doing it as a purist. And here's what's remarkable. I'm going to say one more thing, then I'm going to stop my introduction kind of thing and take questions from the audience. I was talking to this samurai at the Womao. He's this Iaido master, okay? And he's about as classic of the, I don't want to say cliche, but he's pretty much the modern embodiment of what you would call a samurai. He does everything, but his main activity is the Iaido, which is really the ballet form of kenjutsu. So I'm not a fan of it. I'm not an admirer of it. It is ballet. And martial arts that do not involve making physical contact with another person or weapon do not teach you the principles of martial arts. Leverage, distance, timing. Okay, it's not adversarial. It's ballet. Ballet is not a bad thing, but ballet is not going to help you win fights.
Right.
Now, it's wonderful that Iaido practices cutting on targets. Great. Except that I'm not impressed with it because they put special edges on it to make the maximum cutting effect they can, and everybody oohs and ahs. And when you call them on it, they go, nuh-uh. And then you say, well, guess what? Blades don't just cut at cuttable materials. Blades have to encounter resistant materials, armor, and other weapons. That's when you need to see how the edge holds up. And if you put too fine an edge on it, the weapon is trashed. But if you go, well, my weapon cannot and will not ever be allowed to contact anything other than a test target, well, then you're not doing a test, are you?
I think I actually saw a video of you doing that on the a heavy bag. Mm-hmm. When you were displaying the cutting power of the longsword as in relation to when you're trying to grab it and people being afraid to cut their hands.
Yeah, exactly. So I was talking to him and he said that, I said to him, I go, let me ask you a question. And I put him to him point blank. It was over breakfast. And I said, you know, you are the embodiment of traditional teachings. However, and these are supposedly unbroken, unchanging teachings that have been preserved. Okay. However, would you not, I said, it is historical fact, and would you not also admit that the samurai of 1250 did not fight the same way as the samurai of 1450, and they were not fighting in the same manner as the samurai of 1650, and they were not fighting and training and practicing in the manner of the samurai of 1850. So then, which one of these samurai are you practicing, emulating, preserving, recording? You know, which one are you doing?
Mm.
And I folded my hands and waited for the translator to translate. And he goes, and he nods. And he's a wonderful guy. And he says,
right.
Mm. And he answers. And the translator answered for him and said, this is a very good question.
dot, dot, dot.
And the answer is all of them and none of them. And I said, thank you. I interrupted her to say, thank you. That's what I wanted to hear. And that would be the only acceptable answer that I would respect. And I was surprised that he said that. And because that is the answer I give when someone says, well, what part of Mare are you doing? And the same explanation I give is the one he gave, which was remarkable. And that is, we can't really lock onto any one of them because it did change. So we can only say, well, this is how they did it here. And then this is how they did it then. And this is how they did it then. And this is what we know about this. And this is what we know about that. And this is how we're doing it now. And so to be ever aware of the differences, that's how we educate ourselves, that's how we present the subject, and that is how we validate its authenticity and its genuineness. Make sense?
Yeah. Makes sense. Oh, yeah. It makes plenty of sense.
I'm done.
Okay.
Well,
so,
thank you guys, it's been fun. Bye-bye.
Let's, you know, there's a lot of people that are listening to the show that are, you know, practitioners and studiers of Mare and the and everything, but they also have, you know, girlfriends, spouses, friends, family, cousins listening to the show with them as well. So let's give them a little background, kind of like an origin story of John Clements, how you came to the art, how you came to be the director of Arma.
Well, okay, if that's interesting enough. I had been the long, I've told the story many times, and the short version of the long version is that I had been literally playing with swords since kindergarten. I have many vivid memories of in growing up in Florida where we would break off palmetto branches, and palmetto branches, if you've ever seen a palmetto tree, is a sword-shaped limb. And when they're dry, they're very light, and you can whack them all the time, and then they'll break in half cleanly, and you can go at it. But when they're alive, if you cut it, then it's a very stiff reed with a blade-like shape. Hell, it actually has a bit of an edge on each side of it. And I grew up playing with those and watching movies and playing. And when I was 12 years old, my father made me a collection of wooden swords. He put a ton of effort into making some beautiful wasters and short swords and various types of shields so that we could all play gladiator in the neighborhood. But they all broke after a while because we were just bashing them to pieces. And he had several large blades that were from the Vietnam era that were like machetes, but they were like super heavy machetes. I mean, we're talking like a quarter inch thick on the back of them. And I had damaged them by hitting them together to my dismay. It's like, wait a minute. You know, we hit them together and they're ruined. That's not possible. And that's when I realized, holy crap, this is all garbage. All the stuff you're seeing in movies and TV shows is garbage. And all the stuff that I'm hearing done with different types of weapons is garbage because the weapons are ruined. And also growing up in Florida, citrus plants, and our deputy director, John Farthing, did the same thing. We've shared anecdotes about this. Citrus is everywhere. So I had in my backyard orange trees, lemon trees, grapefruit trees, tangerines everywhere. And there's so many of them, they just fall in the yard and rot. And so everybody's like, please take, you know, whatever you want. Well, we would go up to a grapefruit tree and hack those grapefruit. So I grew up being able to hit and target things that are head-shaped and face-shaped size targets and that you actually can impact and cleave through. And when I was about 13, my mom got at a garage sale four cheap wall hangers from this company called Marto. I don't think they're in business anymore. They were out of the Philippines, and they made Spanish wall hangers, Spanish replica wall hangers. And they were garbage weapons, but in the hands of a 13-year-old, it's this immensely heavy actual blade, right? So, you know, it took me years to realize they were junk, but I grew up with these four swords, two long swords, two side swords, being able to practice hitting things. So when I was 14, I got my dad signed me up for fencing lessons at a huge surprise. Didn't even know what sport fencing was, but he signed me up for lessons, private lessons. Mm-hmm. And for the next 2 years, I took private lessons in foil and then eventually started doing some saber. and then moved from that into the APE. But for 2 years, 14 to 16, I had private lessons and was competing in some tournaments against college-age kids whenever they allowed me to enter them, and local. And this, you know, transformed my understanding, because no longer was I just watching movies and emulating stuff, or reading books on things. I was actually getting instruction in how to move and step and parry and riposte and all that. So that changed my entire understanding. Yet at the same time, I was constantly arguing with the teacher, saying, but that wouldn't work, but that wouldn't work, but that wouldn't work. Because I'm actually hitting things with swords. And I had been, you know, sparring with kids all for years where we were allowed to grab each other and we were going against spears and shields and all that. So when I was 15, I started an organization called the MBC, Medieval Battling Club, at my high school. And it spread all over the county. And we had heard of other kids that were also doing similar things. And everybody was using, like, anything you could. I mean, people would show up. You'd get a weekend, 25 kids would show up, and people had just, this is what I made. And we'd look at it and go, oh, yeah, okay, you can use that. And some guy would show up with like a piece of aluminum with duct tape, a ball of duct tape, and we'd go, no way.
Oh God.
Have like a broomstick where he had, you know, masking taped some foam on the edge, and we'd go, yeah, whatever.
We'll take it.
It was truly insane. So after a while I said, no, we're gonna standardize the weapons and we're gonna have some safety rules.
Oh God.
You'd have people where, you know, you'd hit them in the shin and they would ignore it, going, we don't count the shin. And we'd go, bullshit. Who you tap him in the elbow and he would die. And we'd go, what are you doing? No, that's just a half hit. Oh, well, when we play, that's a full kill. You know, and then you'd have a guy who you'd hit in the hand and he'd ignore it, going, well, hands off target. And we'd go, no, it's not. So it was just it was chaos. So that we had to standardize things. And my understanding, I was still doing the Medieval Battling Club as recently as 1992.
Wow.
And recently. from my understanding, the organization still exists. It's still out there. It's one of those dagger here, amp guard kind of groups now. You know, because we didn't have magic and we didn't do that kind of stuff. I mean, I did engage in some LARPing before it was called LARPing. And I had been doing LARPing from about, I was embarrassed to admit, but it was fun at the time.
Yeah.
From about 87 through 95, I was still doing it, but we didn't call it LARPing. We called it questing or dungeoning or battling. And we had all sorts of stuff, you know, trolls and dragons and special effects and magic, but it was separate from the MBC. Yeah. So anyway, when I was about 25, I decided to abandon all of that stuff and focus exclusively on doing martial arts, because I got hold of a copy of one of the Talhoffers, one of the Fiores, and I got hold of Silver and Degrassi in English and Saviolo in English. And I said, oh my God, this is what we should be studying. Oh, I got to back up. There was a book that was recently republished called The Art, The History and Art of Personal Combat by T. Weiss. And it was incredible because he basically took Egerton Castle's School and Masters of Defense from the Middle Ages to the Renaissance, published in, 1885? He took that book and kind of borrowed from it and then pushed it a little further, but shortened it. So after reading Weiss's book in high school, that's when I was inspired to do this stuff more realistically, because I had gone around to different martial arts instructors in my town and asked for weapon instruction. And whenever they had it, all it was katas. And I said, well, don't you spar? And they're like, no. And I'm like, well, you know, me and my friends are sparring every weekend. And they're going, no, you must get a black belt. Then we will teach you weapons. I go, why teach weapons after you've learned the unarmed art? And why is your weapon instruction just slow motion dance routines? It didn't make sense. And of course, it took me years to realize the reason was because weapons are the great equalizer. And some of these instructors would get their ass kicked by a 15-year-old who's just sparring quickly. with a foam weapon or shinai or what have you, or the teachers were not skilled enough to be able to go up against an unskilled guy who's swinging a staff or a boken in their face, which is reminiscent of Swetnam's statement that a true master should be able to play with both the lion and the lamb. or Silver's statement that a true master of defense can take to the field against any man and come away unharmed, whether the guy's skilled or unskilled, sober or drunk, and that you have to be able to fight that. Although he never did address whether the guy was drunk and skilled or drunk and unskilled. There's a lot of permutation.
Right. So in life, there's not really a set of rules. You should be able to take on any opponent at any time.
Exactly. Yes. And that's one of the problems with sport fencing. Sport fencing, my coach would tell me, oh, never fence with an unskilled fencer. You'll pick up bad habits. And they don't know how to fence. And so they move too erratically and unpredictably, and they're dangerous, and they'll hit you. And I'm like, well, there you go. And you don't see that view until the mid-17th century. That's when the earliest time you see that kind of reference, when you see a master saying, look, we're going to study the single rapier. We're going to do it this way. They don't have masks to protect them. And we're going to practice in this very structured manner and be sure not to practice or even ever go in a duel against a guy who's not trained because he doesn't have the etiquette, he doesn't have the comportment, he doesn't have the deportment, he's dangerous, and he'll kill you. And I always said, and in the 18th century, 19th century, you see that become ingrained as doctrine. Never fence against the untrained fencer, he'll kill you, which is insane.
Oh, yes.
And the analogy I use, it's like somebody saying, oh, you have learned karate. Remember, never fight against a non-karate man. He beat you up. Karate only work against other karate men. Then why would you study it?
Sure.
That's how things went. So all this kind of attitude, you know, was in my head when I would encounter Asian martial artists and say to them, well, what about the Western martial arts? And they would go, there are no Western martial arts. You guys didn't have any. And I would always say, that doesn't make sense. We have modern fencing and we had all this great arms and armor that's just uncomparable. And we had all this knowledge in Greece and Rome. Why wouldn't we have had equally sophisticated ways of fighting to match our arms and armor? And they would go, oh, well, you know, you don't need martial arts when you're wearing all that armor. And I'd go, but not everybody wore it.
Yeah.
And then they'd go, oh, well, the weapons are too heavy. And I go, that's not true. So they would just, they didn't know crap, and they would just, you know, make it up or bullshit. And then I'd read books on stage combat and say these guys are clueless. They're essentially acknowledging they don't know anything and that they're making it up. And their doctrines and theories would get you killed within seconds if you tried this out on the weekend with padded swords. And then the last element to this equation was coming across organizations like the SCA, the Society for Creative Anachronism, and going to their events and seeing a bunch of fat guys sitting on their knees or sitting literally sitting on their asses trying to spar and with round sticks and not having any difference between edge and flat and not hitting below the knee or the foot and making excuses for it and covering their hands with gauntlets and not counting those hits and having big saber guards on what are supposedly medieval weapons and not allowing half sorting and just fighting in an abysmally ridiculous way that was reminiscent of our Filipino stick fighting just in armor. And they were horrible. And when we would get them to take off their armor and spar us, and we're just teenagers, and these guys are like, you know, college kids and older. And when they would spar us with our padded weapons, we would kick the crap out of them because they didn't know how to guard their shins or their feet or their hands. And they couldn't use the weapons the way we would. And now they had an edge and a flat because we had weapons that were sword shaped. And so we would tear them apart. And so all this led to me eventually, like I said, in around 92, 91, 90, 91, when I got hold of some of the early manuals, that's when I said, okay, I'm committing myself to the study of this stuff.
Yeah.
And it was about that same year that I got my first real sword. I got a Deltin war sword. And I wrote to the late Hank Reinhardt at Museum Replicas, and I said, yeah, I got your catalog. It's awesome. There's great information in there. I've been reading these books by Ewart Oakeshott, and he's amazing. And finally, there's somebody who knows. I mean, Oakeshott, he basically looked at these weapons as functional tools and not as dead artifacts, as he used to say, not as art are objects that you hang on a wall, but as living things that were wielded by young men to do violence. And so he examined them from that point of view. And though he was not a practitioner, he would have been if he had lived earlier, or I mean, you know, later. And it was amazing. So Reinhardt said, yeah, this guy Oatshot's incredible. And Reinhardt guided me in by saying, well, here's some practical knowledge about how steel works and how real weapons work, and the importance of cutting experiments and things like that. But ultimately, Reinhardt was a businessman trying to hawk the swords that his company was producing. And so when his company started producing lemons, he continued to rave about them because he didn't give a crap. He was trying to earn a paycheck. Whereas I'm trying to learn the truth and trying to gain wisdom and trying to encourage other people to do so. Mm-hmm. So the more that we discovered of the historical sources, the more it contradicted his pet theories and his experiences or lack of experiences. And the more indignant he became towards the subject. So anyway, he created an organization in the mid-90s called HACA, H-A-C-A, Historical Armed Combat Association. And he said, send in $32 and you can become a member and we'll send you our rules of how to spar and you'll be part of this brotherhood. And we don't care what kind of role-playing you're doing and we don't care what kind of costume you wear. It's irrelevant to training with the weapons. Mm-hmm. And it's all about steel weapons. And so this was a great thing. And he got like hundreds of people who signed up. But then he took their money and did nothing.
Goodness.
He didn't even send out the sparring rules to every person who registered. So in 1994, I was living in Orlando, had gotten out of the Navy, and I said I was going to school again and studying medieval history, in fact. Mm-hmm. And so that changed my view towards things again. And so I called him and said, Hank, this HACA thing is defunct now. You've abandoned it. Let me take it over. Let me run it. Let me grab the ball and see what I can do with it. And he said, sure. And I said, okay, you know, can you officially send me a letter saying this? You know, so I took it over, and I can't remember what happened next, except that by 96, we had a website. And we were getting in a forum, and we put a few scans online, and we were in a few video clips and a couple essays, and we were getting tons of response. But people, a lot of the response was like, awesome, this is what we need. You're approaching it as a martial art. You've abandoned the costumed role-playing side of it. You're equating it to any, you know, historical, traditional Asian style, and you're offering a set of sparring rules and designs for padded weapons. And you're putting up video clips that moving in a way we haven't seen people do. Mm. So I was getting a lot of response. And within, I don't know, at some point we said, in order to pay for the site and to pay and to justify the amount of time being put into it, we'll have a membership thing.
Right.
And then I started teaching a class in 1991 or 92 in the Western Nevada Community College, where I was out in the Navy in Nevada. I started teaching a public class out there and was getting like 15 and 20 students at a time. And I was really just teaching them how to spar and then giving historical lectures about the contents of Oakeshott's books. And that was really it. I didn't know what I was doing. But between that time and about 96, I had come up with a pretty thorough study guide. And I sent it to Hank Reinhardt and said, what do you think? And he said, John, this is 40 pages of genius. You really have given this a lot of thought. You've got a lot of, you know, stuff here and your drawings are great. You should publish this as a book. And I went, yeah, right. Seriously. He said, all you have to do is expand it by another, you know, 30, 40 pages, just double it. And I go, but I don't have any more to say. And he goes, sure you do. You could talk about this and this and this. And I went, oh, he's right. So I started working on it. And then I stopped working on it to write something else. I said, okay, too many people are, as Oakeshott pointed out, confusing rapiers with Renaissance single hand swords simply because they have similar hilts. But they're used differently. And I know this because I have a rapier from Deltin, I have a side sword from Deltin, and I have a war sword from Deltin. And these three swords, the swords that appear on our Arma logo,
there it is.
They function differently.
It was destiny.
they handle differently, they're differently, and people got to stop confusing them and equating them in what they can do and everything else. And this is self-evident from handling them, and this is self-evident from cutting with the sharp ones, and this is self-evident from looking at the source material. So I stopped work on my medieval sword and shield stuff to do a similar study guide on the rapier and side sword, but this time to do it as if I'm going to publish it as a book. Mm-hmm. So I naively, totally naively, without knowing, sent the manuscript off to like 7 different publishers, not knowing that you're not supposed to do that. And the first one who responded saying, we'd like to publish it, I went, okay. Mm. And that was Paladin. And then Paladin said, okay, sign this contract. I said, no, you don't understand. The book's not done. And they said, we don't care. We want it as is. I said, no, the book isn't done. So long story short, we reached a conclusion where I would get another 3 months to finish it. So I rushed it into production. And they published it, and it was full of mistakes and flaws and typos and things. Even some of the drawings were upside down. And it was the first book of its kind in over 100 years, and so it kicked open the door to this genre of Western martial arts books. And it also allowed me to finish the medieval book, which I left out the half-swording because I didn't think anyone would believe me that you could half sword. And because I wasn't confident enough in how to do the half sorting to include it, so I left it out, despite it being all in Talhofer and Fiori, I couldn't justify. I thought, if I show myself grabbing the sword, people will say I'm insane and a fool. You can't grab a sharp sword. All right. And Reinhardt was no help because he didn't understand a thing about half sorting and was skeptical of it himself. I left that out, and then I got a bunch of the stances wrong because the sources I was using for translations were wrong, and so they gave me wrong translations of Fiori and Talhofer. And then I included I still was in the mindset that the way war swords were used and the way we fight must be similar to, say, Kenjutsu. And it took me years to get out of that mindset that, no, we're not built like feudal Japanese. We don't step like them. We're not wearing their shoes. We're not wearing their clothing. They don't sit like us. They don't walk like us. They don't have our center of gravity. They don't have our leg and foot dimensions. They don't dance like us. And their weapons don't have the same geometry as ours, nor do we have the same temperament and philosophy. And there's so many tremendous differences. Stop looking at the subject from the point of view of what pop culture has said to us about samurai and katanas. And that's still my main argument I have to give to certain audiences. So anyway, so the books got me a lot of attention and a lot of hatred. Oh my God, did it hit me. It pissed off the SCA because I have a whole section saying you're an idiot if you're fighting by sitting on your ass or kneeling down. It pissed off the sport fencers because I called them out and said they claim to be masters of fencing, but they're only masters of an artificial, convoluted, modern game of tag. They know nothing of the historical methods. Their masters have known nothing about it. Their masters were the ones who abandoned it and forgot it and turned it into something else. They are not the repositories of martial arts knowledge of the West. They are the suppositories of Western martial art knowledge, and they have preserved nothing, and they are no authorities to defer to or refer to because their documented writings and opinions on medieval and Renaissance combat going back to the 18th century, their documented opinions are that there was nothing to it, that it was garbage, that it was inferior, that it was nothing but tricks and wrestling and hacking with heavy weapons. They're on record saying we know nothing about it. So they cannot today go, oh, fencing masters, fencing historians, that's us. Hey, yeah, come on. No, they must forever be branded with the label of ignorance. Mm. They have done nothing to recover this craft, to reclaim it, to rebuild it. They have done everything to stymie it, to shit on it, to block it. And the same goes for groups like the SCA, who want to role play it and turn it into a fantasy and distort it and do all that crap. So I looked at the reenactment groups in Europe and I went, oh my God, they look fantastic. Why can't any of them fight? And the reason was that they don't want to damage their beautiful costumes and garb and armor and their expensive kit. So going out for the weekend and camping like you're a soldier from the Hundred Years' War or from Hastings or from, you know, a pike and musket era, that's wonderful. Oh, wonderful. But when they're fighting, they're going, well, let's not hit to the helmet or to the body. Let's not hit to the edge of the shield. Let's just tap weapons edge to edge or hit to the face of the shields or tap to the arms and legs.
Very convoluted.
Yeah, because there's no way to safely do this and preserve our equipment when we're all massed together doing this reenactment. So it's taken years for them to go, okay, now that we have all this source material and actual methodologies and curriculums, we can now on the side go and practice martial arts. But they're not really, you know, that's not really their thing still. So anyway, so I said, well, we're going to take Hakka and we're going to do for the internal skills what the reenactment groups do for the external equipment. Because I can't afford the external equipment. Can't get it. You can't both dress up and do all that and be a full-time martial arts student developing real prowess in the real authentic self-defense methods. Anyway, now I can, but anyway, so that's what we were doing until about the year 2000 when I said, okay, we have so much of the source material now that the model of Hakka being just do whatever you want and being armed combat is wrong, because this is about unarmed and armed combat. It's not about just doing whatever you want. It's about doing only what the masters say to do. So we must focus on the masters alone and on the Western masters, whereas Reinhardt was in love with katanas and sabers and Gurkha knives and other, the whole range of ethnographic bladed weaponry. Whereas like Oakeshott, I'm only interested in medieval and Renaissance. So I wasn't concerned about Roman and Greek and Celtic because there's no source material, you know, or Norse. It's all speculation. It's all conjecture. So that's where I kind of, we deviated from Reinhardt. And that's when I came up with the concept of Arma. And then it became the idea that if you're going to be, and again, this was influenced from some of my Asian martial arts colleagues who said, if you're going to be a real martial art, then you have to have standards and a curricula that's testable. And otherwise, you're just making it up and you're just a bunch of ad hoc groups and you will ultimately achieve nothing but the lowest common denominator, watered down general consensus. i.e. the SCA, reenactors, or sport fencers with a homogenized, you know, committee-created system. The very model that lost the original art. Okay, so this is why I said, okay, then we have to be a private organization, and the model we want to follow is the model of the fighting guilds, the actual fight schools, the Fechtschulen. And this is similar to the model that the Japanese follow today and that the Chinese reconstructed Chinese schools. Don't get me started on whether the Chinese schools today are traditional, pretty much went extinct. Anyway, so that was the model. And of course, that model puts you in conflict with people who go, hey, we're doing something similar. Check us out. What do you think? And I'd have to go, well, that's nice, except that according to what we're doing, it's inferior. Or you're missing this. Oh, well, screw you. I just wanted validation from you. I wanted to be treated as a colleague. I wanted equal respect. Sorry, I can't give it. You don't look good. You don't move good. You're not using the right equipment. You're not using the right rules for your free play. You don't have a program. Your drills and exercises are not effective. You're not showing results. I can't. And you're, you know, I can't, you know, what do you want from me? And what they wanted was to be treated as equals and yet get access to our program or get access to our manuals. And so it created bad blood, especially among sport fencers, stunt fencers, and the SCA. Because I went after the stunt fencers hard. You know, when our source masters are
renegade.
Exactly. When our source masters warn about the Klopfechters and the Gocklers and the Leekmeisters, then we have to follow their lead on that. You know, I mean, so that is how we got started. You know, the internet happened. And the rest was history. Now, what also happened was because of the internet, it allowed five guys to buy some equipment, buy some books, set up a website, and bam, they're now the Talhofer Society of Cleveland. Or they're the Albuquerque Fiore League, or what have you. And now they can you can have like 25 groups that all have 7 or 8 people in it. And they get together, and now there's like 250 of them on a forum. And it's, I'm okay, you're okay, I don't trash you, you don't trash me. We all pat each other on the back. And then once in a while, we'll get together and we'll figure out some way of having some free play to some homogenized, watered-down consensus rules. And I always go, well, good luck with that. That's your model, but that's not my model. My model is the Masters of Defense and their private guilds. Mm. Well, they're public schools that were private guilds. And having an actual testable standards and curriculum and producing real skills. And that's why I've gotten the respect from Asian martial artists that I don't get from people that are, I've been doing this 25 years. And it's like, no, you haven't. You've been doing SCA for 20 years. And then 5 years ago, you started calling yourself a martial artist. Or you've been doing you've been doing Renaissance Fair stunt play for 18 years. And then 9 years ago, you suddenly called yourself a student of historical fencing and started doing it as a martial art. Or no, you were a mediocre student under me running a study group, one of three dozen, for 5 years, and then you quit because you couldn't pass the test, or you quit because I wouldn't give you a teaching certificate to go and make money. So you stole my program, go into competition with us, and are trashing me, and you're full of hate, resentment, and that's who you are, you know. And you and these five other guys are the same way, so now you're all out there trolling the internet. Ugh. So yeah, the internet happened, and then I said about 12 years ago, I'm on record, actually I'm on record 15 years ago, 14 years ago, but I'm on record about 12 years ago saying that ultimately there is a direction that this subject will go, two directions. One is the direction we're in, and the other direction is the sportification or sportification as people try to turn it into a game, a contest. And that
tag.
Promoters will start selling equipment, require the manufacturers will create equipment, promote events that require the equipment. Promoters will sell tickets and registrations to make money, and then it will snowball and it will attract people who just want to compete, who just want to fight. And they are not real martial artists, and they're not embracing the teachings, the ethical and spiritual teachings of the source masters. They're not reconstructing it. They're simply trying to get good at what the rules allow you to get good at, to score a point that the referees can see. And this is the model that is doomed. This is the model of sport fencing. This is how we came into existence, because we didn't like sport fencing. We came into existence because we didn't like the SCA. We came into existence because we didn't want to do stunt combat. And yet now these people are taking this subject and turning it into, overnight, turning it into sport fencing with long swords.
John, can I ask you a question about that? Now, we know that they did have some competitions among themselves in the Renaissance, but no. I always perceived the main difference being that they were preparing for combat. They were training people like the Landschnecht and things like that. What's your opinion on the competitions from the Renaissance period?
That's an excellent question. And I think when we look at it in context, and that's the key component, context is everything. We are looking at a historical period and how young men train themselves to deal with real violence and the mental and physical requirements of that and the mental and physical activities of that. And one of the components of that is free play. In the schools, to fight about, to play a venny. There's no question that they did that. And in the they're doing this in the age of armor and the age of helmets. And yet the source teachings, the manuals, show these people training unarmored, without gauntlets, 95% of the time, mm-hmm. without padding of any sort, without gloves even, 98% of the time. And they're doing this to prepare themselves for the exigencies of real immediate violence on the street, in duel, on the battlefield. I think there's no doubt whatsoever that fighting men also did this recreationally, because it's just fun to spar, to cross weapons non-lethally. Mm. So ultimately, this recreational side of it does get organized, and it gets organized parallel and along parallel lines to knightly tournaments. But knightly tournaments by the late 1400s had become a spectacle. It was a sporting event where there was no very little chance. I'm not talking about jousting. I'm talking about foot combats, where to save face, they're doing things like, okay, we're going to exchange blows. You know, we're going to exchange 7 blows. That doesn't mean points, 7 points. It means 7 blows. And the reason that this safe face-saving element is built in, according to what I have been able to determine and Dr. Anglo concurs, is because if you do it as an actual competitive event in this kind of age, where, okay, the score is 3-3 and the next hit wins, one guy will call bullshit and say, that wasn't a good hit. That wouldn't have hurt me. You know, I got you first. Oh, yeah? Yeah. You want to throw down with sharps? Let's go at it. So it would lead to violence, real violence with these guys. So to prevent that, there's this built-in face-saving measure. And you see this throughout the world's history. You see this in Asia as well. They built in face-saving elements where they don't actually have winners and losers for points. And I think that is reflective in how they did their events. Another thing is that when you have two schools getting together and having a public event, a spec school event, where they're competing with each other, we have illustrations showing these events. And I always go, show me the referees. And people look at the images and go, holy crap, you're right. There's 4 guys in the corners that are standing there with staffs facing the audience, keeping the audience away. Mm. And there's 1 guy in the center with a staff who's the overall director saying, ladies and gentlemen, and around him are pairs of figures going at it with different weapons. But there's not, okay, we're going to have 2 guys go at it, and we're going to have 4 referees and 1 director, and we're going to count points, and we're going to have an exchange. Then we're going to discuss whether the hit was good or not. Then we're going to declare a point. Then we're going to step off. They didn't even do that when they had their public prizings, where one guy, they would allow the fighters to call their own hits. Why? Because if I hit you and you don't call it, I'm going to hit you so hard next time, mm-hmm. you're damn well going to have to call it, because you're going to be bleeding or you're going to be on the ground.
You're supposed to be honorable. So that's they've left it up to the honor system.
It's not honor. It's mm-hmm. more about the practicality of, if you don't acknowledge it, I'll hurt you. Mm-hmm. But if you hurt me, I'll kill you after this. Or my buds will jump you and take you out. And it's those kind of factors are not expressed in the accounts. They're not expressed in the source literature, but they are there in the subtext and the historical record. So when you have these events being put on for purposes of entertaining and raising revenue, there's grudges going on. But when you read the accounts, oh my God, these guys were taking wounds and hits and injuries as commonplace that would be completely unacceptable in any martial art in the world today. Mm-hmm. If you read the account of Georgia Green and his men of Halifax going down to this other village, it's on our website. It's from, I believe, the early 1500s, where they have this casual, hey, let's go fight the guys of this other village in a public event. And all the villagers come out and they go at it. There's 2 deaths. What, he goes, yeah, there was a bit of an argument because one of our guys hit one of their guys in the forehead with a pitchfork too hard and killed him. So there was a lot of apologies.
Oh, man.
And we had to push the guys apart. And it's like, and maybe some money exchanged hands to compensate. I don't know. Because when the thing's all said and done, they all go to the pub together. And I have accounts from Germany from the 1600s where a traveler says, you know, in every village and town you go to on the weekends, the guys come from the pub to the fech school and they go at it. And there's lots of broken bones and bloody heads and all this. And occasionally there's some bad feelings that lead to sharps at night. But to keep that from happening, they try and regulate it. Mm. And they don't allow anybody to come away going, I kicked his ass. Yes. So, you know, the whole context of that and the other element is, remember, in addition to this sporting recreational side, this competitive side, they are the other 2/3 of the time training in martial arts in the schools and in private academies for the real thing. Whereas today we got guys going, I only care about the competition. I'm only training for competition. I'm only learning a few moves that work under the rules. Farthing said to me, he called me up and he was depressed because he said some idiots were going, you don't need to study the source masters. You just need a good coach and need to learn a few moves.
Mm.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
And pray tell, where are these good coaches coming from?
Yeah.
What are they learning from?
And what kind of value? So I compare it to the MMA thing today, where you have these thugs coming out covered in tattoos, wearing trunks covered in that look like NASCAR, you know, advertisements, and they're coming out and they're trash talking and they're slamming each other, and there's not a whole lot of technique. There's mostly just martial spirit and conditioning. And are any of these guys going to ultimately prove to be masters who are teaching self-defense at a high level? I seriously doubt it.
Mm.
Any more than your professional boxers ever became anything other than punch-drunk guys who blew their fortunes on, you know, drugs and prostitutes. So they're not learning the values that our art was built upon and that is inseparable from. And so I don't approve of it. I don't condone it. And I have had some people come to me and ask for coaching, and I have accepted a few of them, and I have taken their fees, and I have given them lessons. But I've told them, you are not going to fight as John Clements' student. You're not going to fight as ARMA guy, because these guys actually weren't ARMA members. But I thought, I'll give you some tips. But I'm teaching martial arts. I'm not teaching the tricks of how to score under this set of rules or that set of rules. Mm. And when I have watched in person and online these tournaments, I'm just disgusted because these guys are not using the art. They're leading with the wrong leg. They're stepping with the lead leg. They're not throwing proper master cuts. They're parry reposting.
Mm.
And they're tagging each other, and they're using swords that are too flimsy in some cases. And, you know, I've been doing this now 36 years, 15 years professionally. And if you've ever been to one of our prizings, you've heard me, or if you've seen the videos, you've heard me state at the beginning, I will not be calling hits.
Right.
And I will challenge anyone on the planet to argue that they are more knowledgeable or have a better eye for what is a good hit than me.
Hmm.
They'd have to state their case and prove it. And yet I will say the nature of this craft is that I cannot see whether that is a good hit or not.
Hmm.
It's not my job or role or position to say, stop, I saw a hit. It is the role of the people who did it, the guy who got hit, to say, I got hit, and the guy who made the hit to say, yeah, I thought so.
Mm.
But you don't go, wait a minute, I hit him and he's not calling it.
Wow.
And you don't go, oh, that didn't hit me, man. And then the other part of this problem of the sportification are the gloves and the padding. When you're wearing these huge gloves, you cannot feel those edges slicing across your fingers or that blade digging into your back of your hand,
mm-hmm.
that edge cutting across your wrist. So you learn to ignore it and you purposely overlook it because the referees can't see it. And your opponent knows he hit you or he thinks he hit you, but he can't quite feel the difference between hitting you on some other part and hitting you on the hand. So you end up fighting very sloppily and you don't learn how to bind and wind, which is the heart and soul of the methods.
Mm.
And one of the best things I do to students is I will take my novice students and I will spend an entire day doing nothing but slicing, slashing, cutting, cleaving, shearing, hacking, chopping, and hitting them on the fingers, hand, and wrists until they're going, holy crap, everything I do, you're just boom, right on my hands and you haven't hurt me or injured me.
That's some condition.
Yeah. Now, what does that tell you? And they go, that I don't know how to protect my hands. And then I say, and now had you been wearing gloves, would you have felt any of this? No. And you would have ignored it and kept coming on. So you'll never learn to defend yourself. You'll never learn to change the grips that you need to change to wield the weapon properly, all because you're insisted upon artificially wearing these padded gloves. And then they say, well, what about gauntlets? And I say, put the gauntlets on. See how their weight changes the center of gravity of your weapon.
Mm.
See the advantage they provide. See the disadvantage that they cause. Then you can compare that to not wearing the gauntlets. But if you just wear padded gloves, you're not getting the experience of either gauntlet fighting or ungauntleted fighting. And hence all the accumulated examples we've compiled, the odd examples of guys in full plate armor in battle and duel, in the sources and historical art, not wearing gauntlets in plate armor. And in some cases, having discarded one gauntlet only.
Mm-hmm.
Unless we think that that is an accident, we can point to tens of figures in the same image, all wearing one gauntlet, all having gotten rid of their right hand gauntlet. Why? Because of what it allows you to do.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I don't want to bitch about the sportification because it's inevitable. And hey, it's a huge advancement over sport fencing. And
right.
It's a huge leap over SCA. But if you got people that are going to go, I'm the longsword champion and I kick ass, I'm going to go step on up, take off the gloves, take off the helmet, take off your gambeson. And let's play a few rounds. And oh, guess what? I'm going to be doing this and this and this and this. Oh, you're not prepared for that because you don't train in those things and they don't allow it? Too bad. That's called fighting. And if you can't do it safely, you're unskilled. And by the way, here's a sharp weapon. Here's some targets. Show me how you can actually put an edge into it and clear through it. Oh, you can't? Because you're used to slapping and tagging your opponent with a flimsy weapon? Too bad. You're not a real swordsman. So, you know, we spent all these last 20 years trying to move away from sport fencing, stunt fencing, and SCA garbage, only to have this inevitably happen as I predicted 15 years ago it would happen. And, you know, it's somewhere on one of the videos... from the Swordplay Symposium International event in Houston in 2000. And then it's also in a podcast from like 2002. And then it's also in some of my forum posts and old E-list posts where I kept saying it's inevitable, it's going to happen. And one of the reasons I knew it was going to happen is because Hank Reinhardt was trying to develop his own line of sparring weapons and sparring gear. And Purple Heart Armories from the very beginning said one of their goals was to develop and sell to market sparring gear for tournaments. And, you know, I just rolled my eyes. I mean, if you look at the SCA with all their specialized tournament artificial equipment, and every single year the SCA's rules have gotten thicker and thicker, and what you're allowed to do has been limited and limited and limited, and what constitutes a legitimate hit has been defined down more and more narrow. Well, this is inevitably going to happen with this. You also will see splintering as one promoter breaks off from another promoter and another guy is bought out by somebody else and some line of product competes with some other line of product. And when you have a guy who's an instructor plus he's a manufacturer and he's selling his own line of gear, that's a recipe for blowing your integrity and blowing any real authority. I was one of the first people to promote the use of nylon and carbon fiber weapons, plastic swords. And then I abandoned them because after 2 years, I declared the experiment a failure and said, no, they do not function close enough to the real weapons. They inhibit you. They cause bad habits and distortions that lead to misinterpretation and misapplication of the genuine methods. So no, don't use them. Well, there's other people out there still pushing the plastic weapons because they've invested in it economically, whereas I have no business relationship with any manufacturer, nor do I sell equipment, nor do I allow equipment to be advertised on armor, nor do I review equipment for the public. So that gives me a legitimacy that a lot of these guys simply don't have who are promoting tournaments. So again, the way to go in this subject is the historical prize playings. So people that are saying tournaments are historical, I'm like, do you mean nightly tournaments? Because you're not doing them correctly. Do you mean the public fechtschulen events? Because you're not doing them correctly. Do you mean the single duels under rules of a cartello where they're using sharps and blood is being drawn? Because you're not doing that. So what is it you're doing? Well, we're doing an artificial modernized, aha! Stop right there. You've just lost the entire moral argument that you're doing something historical. Because we know they did prize playings. And if you're not doing prize playings to test and certify your practitioners under a rank in an actual program, then you are not doing the historical model, are you?
This is Marae Talk.